We've already looked at some of the significant parts of Athanasius' modeling of spiritual discipline, discipleship, and spiritual direction on the life of St. Anthony. We've already looked at the example of Anthony and his formation, what made him a monk, his withdrawal into solitude, the use of and the experience of the local community as a part of his way of formation, his way of spiritual growth. But a very significant portion of this biography consists of a very long discourse lasting from chapters 16 to 44 of the life of Anthony. It's a long sermon, a long discourse, which is obviously Athanasius bringing together of many of the statements and colloquies and wisdom traditions connected with Saint Anthony. And they are a very beautiful early attempt to describe what will be highlighted in the Wisdom of the Desert literature and what will become particularly emphasized and even more specifically organized and ordered in the writings of John Cassian and Evagrius Ponticus and then all the later medieval commentators, and that is a model of virtue, of Christian virtue and of Christian vice. How can Christians adopt and apply the already well-existing and long commented on traditions of Plato and Aristotle, especially of Aristotle and the Stoic and Peripatetic tradition, which had a very precise list of virtues that needed to be worked on, and even a set of opposing vices, which represented the extremes of either excess or deficiency in terms of that specific virtue. In the Christian context, it wasn't so much a matter of vice that listed in both directions. It could be too much of what the virtue was trying to balance or too little of it. The Christian tradition tended to identify vice with particular temptations, with one or another aspects of the unbalancing of that median, which was a virtue. And so, generally speaking, it's not a matter of there being two opposing vices for each virtue, but rather lists of virtues on the one hand and of vices on the other. This existed very early in Christian literature. It's part of the Didache. It's, as we've seen, to some extent part of the Shepherd of Hermas. It's present in a number of very early Christian letters, the idea of a way of light and a way of darkness, a set of commandments, things to be done and things to be avoided. What does the temptation from the demon consist, the devils consist in? It consists in invitations to do these things. God and his angels are inviting us to do the opposite. Well, here we see, with the life of Anthony, a clear internalizing of this and a recognition of the fact that it may not be as obvious as great deeds that damage the community, things that would have to be brought out into the context of a formal sacrament or a formal act of reparation or renewal of connection with the community through public humiliation, through public penance, but of inward recognition of tendencies that lead in one direction or the other. So we'll see here that there's an inward ascesis, a discovery of a way of light and the avoidance of a way of darkness that is now the beginnings of a reading of what we've already seen in the Apothegmata described as the alphabet of the heart. Here we'll find Athanasius, through Anthony, offering us a notion of Christian virtue and of Christian vice in rather general terms, although there are some specific Stoic and Aristotelian backgrounds to it, but adapting it to the particular circumstances of each individual, the necessity for recognizing that each person will have to struggle in their own particular way. So monasticism thus becomes a model for not only external ascetical observance, but the inward practice of discovering the significance, the meaning, the goodness, or the dangers inherent within particular thoughts, particular inward tendencies. So let's look at this great discourse. We'll be looking primarily at chapters 16 to 21 and then 34 to 44. If we look at the beginning of the Great Discourse, chapter 1, we are given two very beautiful kinds of emphases at the beginning of one's model for the quest for virtue. And in many ways, this is also the kind of background against which a notion of spiritual direction or spiritual guidance must be seen. As I've highlighted, the scriptures are enough for instruction. This constant going back to the Bible as the foundational basis for Christian ethics, for Christian spirituality. The scriptures are enough for instruction, but it is a good thing to encourage one another in the faith and to stir up with words. So the scriptures are the basis, they are sufficient, but it is good for us to share with one another our own experience. And here the notion of the scriptures as the primary spiritual guide is in the background, and it is the immediate experience of the struggle with one's own thoughts done in the context of seeking the advice of another that this encouragement, this consolation, this paraklesis takes place. If we drop down then to the lower half of chapter 17, there's a red bar that I've added, a Christianized Aristotelian tetrad of the virtues. Here we have Antony, Athanasius, offering us an invitation to embrace a series of virtues, the first four of which are the classical virtues from the Aristotelian tradition: prudence, justice, temperance, and courage. Of course, particularly in the West, under the influence of Thomas Aquinas, these become the basis for the four virtues, to which is added faith, hope, and love, and those become the seven Christian virtues that Thomas particularly comments on. But this Aristotelian tetrad also included, in Aristotle himself, synesis, or understanding. So if you look at the first five, you realize that what Athanasius is doing is offering his readers, many of whom won't even realize it, a way of understanding their goal as Christians in light of using the language of the classical philosophical tradition. And to that he adds numbers 6 through 10, love, agape, and an extension of this or a modification of it, philoptochia, kindness to the poor, or love of the poor, love of those who are in need. Number 8, faith in Christ, pistis, the virtue of faith. And then freedom from wrath, aorgesia, a willingness to set aside the tendency to take revenge or to seek reprisal. And number 10, hospitality, philoxenia. So there's philoptochia, love of the poor, kindness to those who are in want, and philoxenia, love of the stranger, love of the foreigner, what's been translated here as hospitality. These represent a wonderful complex, which in this particular text are not organized any further, but which in many other authors, especially Evagrius and Cassian, will be specifically divided out and sought, specifically worked on, and often worked on by looking at their opposites, looking at the temptations that tend to keep us from these balances which each of these virtues represents. If we look down at number 19, there's another kind of model for setting up a goal or a set of principles. The first is to borrow from Romans 8, this idea of God as our fellow worker, our sun ergos. God is the one who works with us. So everything, everyone who chooses the good, God is working in them for good. But there's another ideal. This is taken from 1 Corinthians. Notice again the biblical basis, the use of scriptural texts, not at all as proof texts, but as fundamental foci for meditation, for discovering the deeper meaning of, and then using them as almost the fulcrum for one's spiritual life, the standard according to which things are measured. This second text from 1 Corinthians, it is good to consider the word of the apostle, I die daily, a kath hemeron apothnesko. So there is an idea that every day, he says, as we rise day by day, we should think that we may not live to see the next day. Each day should itself be a place of striving that is, as it were, our window into eternity. We're not so much looking at the future as the place where we invest all of our hopes in terms of a temporal future, but we look upon this moment in time, this particular day, as our place to experience God. So on the one hand, God is working with us, and God is working with us in the present moment. And he says this ordering, the maintaining of these two verses, of these two principles, will help us, he says, not to fall into sin, nor have epithumia, lust for anything, a misguided lust, or cherish wrath. And he uses the word maniumen, the verb which actually has to do with an even stronger form of hatred or antipathy than just anger. We will not have wrath against any person, and we won't heap up treasure upon earth. We won't seek for passing things. So if we keep these two principles, and it's almost like the sayings of the Desert Fathers, two biblical verses that kind of provide for us a way of organizing our life, having already seen this tenfold a way of virtue, this is Antony's model for striving for God. He also has a very beautiful description of what virtue is, and we'll see this continuously developed in chapter 20. If we drop down to the the third paragraph where the text is begun to be highlighted, when the spiritual faculty of the soul, psuches ton noeron, the inner noetic or deepest level of the self, and as he puts it, accords with nature, kata phusin. Remember that this is Athanasius' way of describing Antony himself as he comes forth from the fort. Antony is kata phusin. He is living in accordance with nature, not struggling against his nature, but restoring it, discovering what he was made to be. Well, Antony himself is saying that our deepest self accords with nature in virtue. Virtue is our primordial state, that balance, that searching for God that allows us to exhibit these wonderful capacities that he's already described. This is what it means to be according to nature, kata phusin, which he says twice. It accords with nature when it remains as it came into existence. A very beautiful anthropology. The human person was created with the capacity to live in accordance with nature. They were made good by God, and they retain the capacity to perceive and to discover and to know this good. In a later Western moral theology, this will be linked to a notion of synderesis, to a notion even of what comes to be called natural law, and it's virtually equivalent, a notion of conscience, that there is within us a capacity to know, to experience, to rejoice in our own living out of that eternal law, that eternal invitation from God to live as God would have us live. There is within us an awareness of what it means to accord with nature. We are being most truly ourselves when we're exercising virtue. And so he says, uprightness of soul consists in having the spiritual part as it was created, kata phusin, according to nature. He says this again and again in this section. When it swerves and turns away from being accorded to nature, that is vice. Vice is failure to be in accordance with our natural state. So he says, if we abide as we were made, we are in virtue, but if we think foul thoughts, we are vicious. So in regard to our own, and we'll see this process of inward discernment, diakrisis or discretio in the Latin, we are searching for that balance, that virtue that allows us to embrace the good, which at some level we in an inchoate way know, and to reject the evil, which is the source of vice, of vicious behavior. But this is not behavior. This is the inner world primarily of thoughts. So this monastic literature, this life of Antony, is being offered not just to monastic readers, but to Christians of every conceivable type as a model for their own lives to be aware of this inner world in which an alphabet is written that they can learn to read themselves. Now, we're going to skip quite a ways down. We're going to skip two big sections, Demonic Tricks, chapters 22 to 29. And then we're going to skip most of the section that comes after on clarity on and foreknowledge, chapters 30 to 34. And if we go down to the bottom of that section to chapter 34, let me just summarize that Antony gives examples of various experiences of demonic temptation that he has had. And then he talks about the fact that there are those who are misled because they imagine that through demonic assistance, the future can be told, or events that take place far away can be known. He says in number 34 that, well, if this is something we want, if we want to know about the future, or we want to know what's happening somewhere else, well, the key to doing that is to have our souls, as he puts it, perfectly pure. Katharuomen te dianoia. Let us allow our souls to be perfectly purified. Our innermost self, let us be pure in mind, is what he's actually saying. Let us allow ourselves to let go of the things that separate us from God, and then we will have a kind of a clarity that allows us to see. Literally, a clairvoyance. He doesn't mean that you acquire the ability to foretell a future or see things that are happening at a distance, but he does say that the Christian, if a person longs for these things, let them instead look inwardly and seek to be inwardly pure. Let them have a purified soul, and then they will live, as he says, kataphusin, live in accordance with nature. And then the more important section for us, the section on discernment, chapters 35 to 42, I've highlighted in a kind of a yellowish with red text way, these invitations to distinguish, he says, the presence of good or evil. It's easy, he says, to distinguish because the vision of the holy ones, the optasia of the hagion, the seeing of those who are holy, and he means by this our inward experience of thoughts, which are given us, he believes, and this is part of the monastic tradition, by the angels. We're gifted with holy thoughts, holy invitations that are the opposite of the temptations that lead us to sin. These things we can know because they do not cast us into confusion. Teteragamene. We are not confused by them. They don't muddle our thoughts. They don't strive or cry. But he says they come quietly and gently. Hesuchos praos. So the virtues of gentleness and quiet are characteristics of inward experiences of God, inward experiences, he says, of the angelic. And our response to them is joy, gladness, courage. And then the soul that is filled with them also has characteristics, numbers 6 through 9, of being unruffled, undisturbed, enlightened, filled with, as he says, rays by which we behold our own selves and the things around us. And more than that, we are kindled with a longing. I've translated pathos here as urgent longing of what is divine and of things to come. We are, as it were, possessed by a desire, not for physical things, not for things that hurt us or hurt others, but for the things of God, finally for heaven. So this is the characteristic, he says, this is the key to discernment of that which comes from God, comes from the angelic: joy, gladness, courage, quietness, gentleness, the sense of light and of longing for what is divine, for the world to come. Now I've highlighted in gray, by contrast, in number 36, what the experience of the demonic, of the evil is. It is characterized, he says, by confusion, by cryings, by disturbance of one's innermost self. This is characteristic of the demonic assaults. They shout, they make terrible noises, they distract, they confuse the thoughts, they create delia. They create cowardice in the heart. Instead of courage, they create cowardice, a fearfulness that is not fearfulness of God, but a kind of a fearfulness of doing specifically the things we ought. Tumult, tarakos, confusion, dejection. We might even say a sense of despair or profound depression. Hatred towards those who live a life of discipline. Jealousy or even a violent dislike of those who are living the life that contrasts with one's own life of dissipation. Indifference, acedia. Acedia here is translated as indifference, a lack of concern for the things that lead to God. Or grief, sorrow, lupe. And this would not be something that is imposed from without, but a kind of an inward lingering on a sense of sorrow and sadness, seeing no way out. One wonders whether in our own modern world that is so fond of asserting the value of meaninglessness, whether that isn't specifically indulging in this vice of lupe here. And he says remembrance of kinsfolk is problematic. This neme, this remembrance, will take take one away from one's monastic observance, also characterized by fear of death, desire for evil things, and several other characteristics as well. But he then contrasts that again and tries to remind one that in contrast to that, when you have contemplated something, that is to say an inward vision, what seems to be something that comes but you're not quite sure from God or from somewhere else, well, if your reaction, he says, is, and here again it's highlighted in red, joy, cheerfulness, courage, tharsos, not cowardice, but courage, strength, calmness, boldness, and love towards God, take courage and pray, and joy will be the stable state, the katastasis of your soul. So joy and a sense of longing for God is for him the test, the sign of discernment, of discretion, of that which comes from God and from the angels. And again, he gives one more contrast, but if at their appearance there's confusion, threats of death, know that it's the evil spirits. And especially if the soul finds itself cowardly, then you know that there's a presence of the enemies, because the demons do not take away fear when they come. There were holy people who felt fear at the presence of the angels, but only for a moment, and the angels dispelled their fear. Remember Gabriel saying, "Do not be afraid." Well, the demons don't do that. The demons want this fear to be turned into cowardice. If we then drop down quite a few paragraphs to the conclusion, which is in chapter 42, a blue bar that says on number 5, conclusion, thinking on the joys of heaven. Here he reiterates the idea that we should be courageous, always rejoice, consider in our soul that the Lord is with us. These are the things that will enable us to clearly discern between what we ought to do, between what comes from God and what comes from the evil one. And so he says, if you drop down into a highlighted and indented text, if they see us rejoicing in the Lord, reflecting on our future bliss, considering the things of the Lord, then the demons will have no power over us. And we're always to, he says, reflect inwardly on the things of the Lord, and the characteristics are rejoicing and hopefulness. So he repeats again in chapter 43, a vision of the holy ones will reassure us and will change fear into joy, and is characterized by calmness, ataraxia. So in number 44, in the conclusion, Athanasius describes the fact that everyone recognized this was the grace of discerning spirits, diakrisin ton pneumaton. So all of this, the idea of seeing that which comes from God, distinguishing it from what comes from evil, and recognizing the responses within the soul, this is the gift of discernment. Lived out, he says, in the monastic context by, and here's a description of monastic ascesis, singing psalms, loving reading, of course, primarily reading of the scriptures, the source of all wisdom and insight, fasting, praying, rejoicing in the hope of things to come, almsgiving, preserving love and harmony. Note how positive all of these characteristics are, and the characteristics associated with perceiving the angelic. It's not a question of making the soul afraid of not having succeeded. It's not a question of trying to inspire good actions by a fear of hell. On the contrary, it's a recognition that it's precisely out of the encouragement of the vision of heaven that the possibility of real inner transformation takes place.